You're listening to episode 22 of Fear the Boots interview series. In this interview, we talk with Stuart Robertson. Running time for this interview is 56 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name's Chad.
This is Wayne.
My name is John.
And this is Chris.
And joining us today is Stuart Robertson.
Thanks for having me on the show, guys.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, Stuart. Let's go ahead and kick this off the way we do all our episodes. You want to tell our audience who you are, what you do, where you're from, why they should know your name?
I live in Ontario, Canada, and people will probably know me who listen to this podcast from the work that I do with independent role-playing game design and publishing. I've created the Weird West role-playing game, and I have a blog called Strange Magic, and I've participated in the one-page dungeon design contest, and people have liked some of the stuff I've done in that. Generally part of the old-school scene, although I have done some actual play podcast recordings of both original D&D as well as 4th edition.
You also do some art.
Yes, I do.
This is actually how you and I got to talking about role-playing games, was I was asking questions about DeviantArt, and you were the one that answered them for me. And so
I'm one of those guys that wears so many different hats that I sometimes forget about some of them. In addition
very
to
much a one-man band.
Yeah, in addition to some of the stuff that I do, that I publish myself, I also help out a lot of other people with art. And I'm going to have some artwork in module coming out soon called The Manse on Murder Hill. I'm also contributing to a couple of people's Kickstarters, that there's probably going to be more announcements about that in the next few weeks. And here and there, just helping out different people with different fantasy-themed artwork projects.
So how'd you do in the one-page dungeon competition?
I won, although a whole bunch of people win. I think it's not so much about winning. It's about,
yeah, it is. You know,
it's not about winning. It's about crushing the opposition.
It's about getting publicity by losing. No way.
Everyone got a trophy.
We all got a pat on the head and a cookie and a juice box. And
the contest was a tie.
And then they sold your ideas as a high-value published module.
There were some prizes, and we got some miniatures and things like that. And that was, I like miniatures, and so that was lots of fun. But I really like that contest because I think a lot of gamers like the idea of publishing their own adventure. But instead of it becoming this ever-growing, gargantuan thing, it's taking in the opposite direction. And can you distill everything down into one page? Can you have the map and all the room descriptions and everything someone would need to play that adventure and fit it on a single sheet of paper?
I really like the sound of it. It sounds like it would be a lot of fun to just sit down and see just how small can you get this thing and how much information can you fit onto one sheet.
Well, I like the approach in general because I've talked to a fair number of people who have trouble saying things concisely. And a lot of times the people around say, oh, well, you need to go take a class on speaking. And typically they don't. In my mind, what they need to take a class on is essay writing. And if you take a good class on essay writing, they're going to tell you something like, okay, I want you to formulate your thoughts, intro, major points of argument, conclusion, and I want you to do it in 3 pages. And if this is a good essay writing course, they're going to give you something that is very hard to deal with in 3 pages or 2 pages or 1 page. Give me all your thoughts on God. Go.
Ask her why we're who we are.
But, you know, the point being, though, that I like this idea of paring things down because I think there is a creep that you can see, whether it's in novels or role-playing games or whatever, where over time, people start to try and account for more and more and more and more. The size of everything starts creeping and oftentimes in directions that really aren't all that useful.
And I think if you look at a series of fantasy novels, those can be a lot of fun to read. And, you know, if you enjoy writing, a lot of fun to write too. But when you sit down to play a role-playing game, it's not really like reading a book. I think the closest thing it's like would be maybe the script for a play. And if you look at the way a script for a play is set up, the descriptions for, you know, locations and props and things, they're very, very concise because you don't read a play, you act it out. And so I think with games, it's the same kind of thing. You know, you want those concise instructions about what's happening, what's there, and then through us acting it out together and talking with each other, that's where we get to improvise and embellish and make it come alive. I think somewhere along the line, it's gotten too blurred with fiction writing as opposed to creating an outline to run a game with. And that's what I liked about the one-page dungeon contest, because it took it back to that idea. Because if you're going to try to write a page of prose, it's going to be a pretty short evening's game.
Do you find when you get into this kind of thing that there is a simplification when it comes to plots and it comes to kind of the more, you know, esoteric nature of what you might be dealing with? Do you find some way to work around that so you can still add a level of complexity to it rather than just something that might be very straightforward on the one page?
I think when you look at, let's say, you know, Shakespeare or something like that, and you take a look at the script, and of course their dialogue and their monologues, and that's pretty hefty. But if you just look at when people leave and when they go to different places and exit and enter, and the descriptions of locations, it's pretty sparse, but yet a lot of complicated things can be taking place. And so I think if you cut things down to the basics, that there can even be things you don't have to explicitly say, they can be sort of implied. Right? So if you have, I'm making this up right now, an adventure, and you say in one room there is three cultists and they're fretting, you know, and that's the only description you have. And then there's a locked door, and inside the next room there's some sort of ghoul wearing ceremonial robes of a high priest. You don't have to give an explanation for this used to be the high priest called blah, 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 and this is what happened, and he got turned into a ghoul, and his followers don't know what to do. A lot of that can be implied by whoever's going to be running the game. And you also leave that open to the possibility they might have a better idea. They might be able to take those components and do something a little bit different with it. And that's what you often see in theater, where they take the same script. You know, one director may set it during World War I, and another director may set that back in the Middle Ages. And they can do little different things. And so the experience of seeing one version of Hamlet might be very different from seeing another version.
Or The Lion King.
Yeah,
or
The Lion King. And I think that somewhere along the line, we really got into that scripting out a fantasy novel and hoping our players would jump through all the right hoops to get us there, as opposed to sort of setting up premises and sort of scenarios, and then sort of standing back with the players and watching how that might unfold in interesting ways.
Now, I've got a ton of questions and things that I want to talk about that are all bundled up in this approach that you take to game design. But as sort of our central case study, we're going to use Weird West, and I have a bunch of copies of it in front of me, which obviously outside of my fellow hosts here in St. Louis, no one can see us. It's a very thin stack of papers. So we're going to have a little craft time here in a moment, too.
Did you make the origami book with it?
I did. And actually, that's what I want to do here with craft time. And I'll post some pictures of this. I'll be careful to keep them, you know, not to give away the farm here. But let's start off by, do you want to introduce what Weird West is? And like I said, I've got tons of things I want to talk about in the details, but just at the high level, what is the Weird West RPG?
At the highest level, the Weird West RPG is Wild West with all fantasy stuff. In the same way that a game like Dungeons & Dragons is the Middle Ages with fantasy stuff thrown on top of it, and maybe a game like Shadowrun is cyberpunk with fantasy stuff thrown on top of it, Weird West is a Western, a spaghetti Western with fantastic elements. And there have been a lot of Weird West movies made over the years. One just came out recently, Cowboys versus Aliens. That's an example of Weird West. Jonah Hex is an example of Weird West. So that's the genre. Now, the Weird West game, I think what probably makes that a little bit different from a lot of other games.
And hopefully better than Jonah Hex, because that was a really bad movie.
I haven't seen it yet. I haven't seen some of the newer Western movies. But people ask, you know, was there a movie or something that first inspired you? And it was the music video for Muse's Knights of Cydonia. I don't know if
yes.
you guys have seen that.
Oh, yeah, I have seen that. Absolutely.
So I saw that and I was like, oh, that's awesome. And these cowboys and the kung fu fighting, and there's like crazy robots, and there's dirt bikes and lasers. And I'm like, yes, let's do something like that.
I will see if I can find that and link it in the show notes for anyone that's not seen
it. It's all over the internet. You'll find it.
It's a fun
video. It's a decent song, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so for years, like I imagine like a lot of other gamers, I'd been tinkering away with, you know, my own homebrew role-playing game. And I thought, you know, one day I'm going to publish this. And then I was looking at some of the ones that had come out more recently, and their page count had been so huge and there was so much stuff in them. I decided to just zig when everyone else zagged, or zag when everyone else zigged, and take it in exactly the opposite direction, in the same way that the one-page Dungeon Contest had pared everything down and made it more streamlined. And to streamline an entire game like that, I found instructions online for making these little origami booklets out of a single sheet of paper. And so that became one of the design criterias.
Let's start with that. Prior to this episode, you sent a copy of Weird West my way, and it's available on DriveThruRPG for $1.
That's right.
So you're not risking a whole lot to try this RPG out. And quite frankly, having read through the rules and looked at this book and also things that come with it, you're definitely getting your buck's worth out of this. I will link this in the show notes. If you have a dollar and just want to see what this is all about, it is well worth the purchase. Stuart, I want you to tell everyone what they get for that dollar, and then we're going to have craft time here around the mice.
Okay. There's two versions of the game. One that's been formatted to look nice on a, well, certainly on a laptop, but also on a smartphone. I have an iPhone, but I've also seen it on, you know, other types of phones. And so you can carry it around in your pocket. You've got the complete rules. You don't have to pinch and zoom or anything like that. It's readable just the way it is. And then it prints out on a single sheet of paper and folds into this little origami book, and you can put it on your wallet, put it in your shirt pocket, print out one for everyone at the table, and then everyone has a copy of the rule book. Looking at the number of words per page and average reading speed of people in North America, it's something you could give to everyone. Everyone could read it and make characters and start playing all within 10 to 20 minutes. And that was something else I wanted to do.
Yes, if even that long. Mm-hmm. All right. So what I'm going to show the guys here, and I'll describe this for those of you that are obviously not here.
Don't describe it. Just rub it up against the microphone. Everyone will hear it.
All right. But what I'm handing out to you guys, this is the 8-page rule book that goes to Weird West. Now, for those of you at home, what I'm passing out to these guys, it is only one page. It is a single 8.5 by 11 printed sheet of paper. And what you do is it comes with these instructions where basically what you do is you take that 8.5 by 11, I'll try to describe this as best I can. You take that 8.5 by 11, okay, that you guys have, you fold it in half, like that straight down the middle. You then fold.
Wait.
Okay, you're doing it with me. All right.
Jeez.
You fold it
Bob
in half,
Roth,
like straight down the middle.
Not.
There are no mistakes. There are only happy,
happy accidents.
You then, along these lines, so now you have a sheet of paper. It's folded in half.
Ripped? I can't handle this.
All right, I'll get to that in a second.
I'm going
to
eat the paste.
So then you take these two outside flaps, and you're going to fold them up like this. So you effectively have a piece of paper that is now folded into quarters, such that it's 8.5 wide by 1/4 tall.
This is why Wizards of the Coast make so much money. They do the folding for you.
Well, yeah, but all right. Now the next part, I don't have the scissors.
Right? I don't know.
Yeah. You got it basically right. All right. So the next part, we can't do because I don't have scissors handy. But I'll show you what you have to do. Then is you then make one cut right here down the middle.
I have scissors.
Oh, Chad has scissors. Okay.
All I can think of is that little Caesars commercial from years ago. You ever hear of origami? And then he folds the box into some sort of pterodactyl.
Did you ever make the pterodactyl? They actually ship the box lids with the pterodactyl instructions, and we actually made the pterodactyl.
Really? No, yes, my in our class, let me tell you a true story. I could never, and still can't to this day, make paper airplanes. In sixth grade, I was in class. The lesson coming up was about how to make paper airplanes. I faked sickness so I could get out of the class.
Chris, you are a sad man.
I was embarrassed to go and try and make paper airplanes.
Okay, so while they're cutting this, all right, so Chad, then all you're going to do next is you now have the front and back cover together here in this fold.
Okay.
You're going to fold this backwards so you have the front and back. You're going to fold this one the opposite direction. Uh-huh. Now bend it over like this.
Uh-huh. Close your leg behind here.
You now have an 8-page rule book.
Oh my God. How come yours is so much straighter than mine? Mine's
well, because I was sitting there at work as opposed
because
to doing
Dan
a podcast.
Extensive notes, Chad, so, you just wing it. That's
as a result, you can see, and I also did a little bit. I cut off.
How the chart is on the back.
Yeah, too. And that's, so check this out. Out of one 8.5 by 11 piece of paper.
Mine looks like crap.
For those of you who are like, what the hell's going on here, and you're not following my descriptions, I will post a couple quick snaps of this with the show notes so you can see what the hell we're
talking
about.
Post a picture
about.
Of yours. Mine doesn't look
post
good.
Post a picture of yours, and then post a picture of mine. And that is the difference
right,
between our
but here, I'll
styles.
Let you look at mine then. So as you can see, you have, out of 8.5 by 11, an 8-page rule book.
You trimmed yours.
If you cannot read that in 5 minutes, 10 minutes top, you seriously have a literacy issue. And yet, I read the whole thing prior to this recording, and what I saw in there was, quite frankly, very sufficient to run a rules-light, quick-play role-playing game. And in fact, honestly, what this reminded me of as I was sitting there holding it, this is like a gamer tract. Like, we should be going around the city, like, leaving these next to phones and leaving these in grocery stores to get
shouting
people
at lawyers trying to go to municipal court. Not that I ever have that happen.
The Jack Chick thing wasn't lost on me when I came up with
it. That was exactly what came to mind. It's like, I have the reverse of the Black Leaf Jack Chick track.
The last.
You go online and you go to Google and type in Pocket Mod. You can find all sorts of templates for creating your own little origami booklets. And so if someone did want to do that, they certainly could.
I'll put mine out there. So if you guys want to look at this, but all right. So,
I'm really disappointed in my skill at this, actually.
Well, I was sitting at work and had his desk and a straight edge, so I was able to make mine a little nicer. So then the other thing, now, Stuart, I don't know if this is included as part of the RPG Now download or not, but the character cards here, where do those come from?
That is a perk that I sent out to contributors to our Indiegogo campaign.
Okay.
I use those at conventions when I run demos. I like having physical props at the game table. I made my own GM screen out of some recycled CD cases. I built my own dice tower out of some foam core. I got the idea that rather than have character sheets, we should have CCG-style cards for everyone's characters. Because it's a Western game, they're holding like playing cards, like, you know, they're gamblers in a saloon. And so I like having that artwork and imagery that gives you a better feeling about the genre.
When you do those kinds of things, though, does it add more for you, or does it add more for your players, or both?
I think both. And I think a lot of people, there's different overlapping facets of the hobby, right? So some people love to paint miniatures, and some people love to write gaming fiction and character backgrounds. And some people like DIY craft time. That's one of the things that I like, is having those physical props, because we're playing a tabletop game. And one of the things I like about board games, like the stuff from Fantasy Flight Games, like Arkham Horror or something like that, is how nice the tactile physical pieces are. I mean, you could play the same game with just scraps of paper, but the components are so nice. And I like the idea of when we play a role-playing game, I mean, if it's possible, to have some of those nicer components as well.
Let's talk about these cards here for a minute, because you were able to fit a full character on something no larger than a playing card.
Yes.
And over half of that is taken up by the character portrait, which are these great little cartoons. I took this apart, and there are actually, on each of these, 9 distinct elements, not counting the name, so 10 with the name.
Do you do any work that at work?
What kind of work? Depends on what the meaning of work.
Oh, okay.
Is. You have the class level. Mm-hmm. You have their stamina rating. Okay, that's the first 3, class, level, stamina rating. They have 4 basic stats, fighting, grit, magic skill. And then on each of these, you gave them an additional 2 little perks that kind of fleshed out that character. You know, for example, you have an adventurer here. If you don't mind me giving you a little bit of this one.
Oh, no.
Okay.
No,
you have an adventurer here, and like his 2 traits is...
You have to pay him a dollar, though.
Because he's like such kind of a high-class guy, he's not allowed to make any lethal attacks. But in return, any lethal attacks made against him have a chance of being turned into non-lethal damage. And all the characters have these kind of these 2 little quirks to sort of give them flavor. And with each of these characters, once again, without pages and pages of character sheets or even one huge tiny print packed sheet, I have characters here that give me a real sense of what I would be playing. And I say this not as a man who's opposed to crunch, because I like crunchy games and I don't mind being handed a 300-page rule book, but I still think it is a real feat and it is an excellent feat, especially when you're trying to throw down a quick game, get someone started in the hobby or whatever, to be able to have an entire RPG that makes sense and is well presented on one side of an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. That is absolutely amazing. I mean, this is worth the dollar I didn't give you. So if you if you ever come to Fear the Con, I'll give you a dollar off your ticket.
Sounds good.
All right, but here's the several questions I want to ask you about this. And by the way, for anyone who's curious, after I trimmed off the edges, the final product, I measured it. It's 3 inches wide by 4.5 inches tall. Okay, that's how big this thing is. So it's real easy to pour it around. You get one of those little tubes of small-sized dice, you've got a whole RPG right there in your pocket. All right, so let's start with this. One of the things that I noticed as I was going through this is obviously, per your comments a little bit earlier about Shakespeare and kind of the creep of size in role-playing games, there is not a whole lot of anything in here about setting. The dispute resolution is very simplified. There's nothing in here that explains to you what an RPG is.
There's totally setting. Have you seen the cover? There's a tentacle coming off the eye. There's a guy with a gun. And then there's like all these Mike Mignola awesome looking skeletons.
We'll come back to Mike Mignola. But let's start with these elements that you decided to strip away. Why'd you choose to strip them away? And I've got some follow-up questions, but let's just start there.
I think some of the things I decided didn't need to be included because we live in a different era than the one where Dungeons and Dragons was first introduced. I don't think in the age of World of Warcraft and Paper Mario RPG and things like that, that you need to explain to people the premise for a role-playing game quite the same. We can draw on some of that previous stuff, and Dungeons and Dragons does exist. It's part of pop culture and something that's been part of role-playing games from the beginning, but we've maybe forgot about that, is most people get introduced to gaming by another person. And so when you look at some of the really old books, there's a lot that's missing from them. And when I did a little bit of research, that was because there was an assumption that you were being taught the game by someone else, and they were explaining how it worked. And what was in the book was just sort of the reference material to keep things consistent. But the actual, what are we trying to do here? What's this game about bit? That was sort of an oral tradition where someone told me and I'm telling you and you're going to tell your friend. So when I looked at, okay, what can we cut out of this to make it all fit in a page? That was all things to be removed, was the, what is a role-playing game and how do you win and things like that. And the other thing is, different people play them in different ways. And so it's a toolkit that different types of Weird West games can be played with. And so how I might play it and how I might think you're supposed to win might not be the same as how you play it. And I think that's okay, just in the same way that, you know, people could take those different Shakespearean texts and interpret them in different ways. And so that goes into the whole setting thing. It's deliberately concise. Now, there's bits in there that might get your imagination going, but really what my hope is that people would take it and then they would make something with it. They would get into the DIY side of things and they would make an interesting setting or an interesting scenario. And maybe one person is really into dinosaurs, right? Like the Valley of Guanji type old cowboys and Ray Harryhausen dinosaurs. And that's their idea of Weird West. And then someone else, it might be all about zombies, you know, the zombie apocalypse out in a gold mining town. And then someone else, it might be more gonzo, wild, wild west type stuff with steampunk elements and everything else. And I think those are all possibilities. And so far, what I've heard from all the people who have posted about running this at conventions and stuff is that they really got that idea right away, that it doesn't have this in it. And because it's so concise, they look at it and say, well, I could add that. I don't need to wait for someone to officially tell me that it's okay to add two sentences to my game. And so it empowers them to turn around and do that. I like that.
Let me tell you a couple things here. I'll tie in an anecdote with this. When I picked it up, what you described is very much what I saw. And the phrase that came to my mind is it's almost like a Rorschach test. You put something in somebody's hand that kind of gets them thinking about rules. There's a tiny little bit of implied setting. There's a few passing comments about the relationship between the player and GM. But so much of it is just implied, such that when you put it in front of a person, they have that freedom to interpret it their own way. Now, the anecdote I was going to tell you, let's go way back into pre-Fear the Boot history. When we were setting up Fear the Boot, do you know how many RPG podcasts we listened to?
Did you listen to either a whole bunch or zero?
The answer is zero. And here's why. That's not to say there are not
great... We thought they were dumb.
Because I don't have an iPod.
That's not to say there are not great shows out there today. Or there weren't back then, because there were and there are.
There were us and
yeah, we were
us.
There then and we're still here now. Yeah. But the point being, what that let us do was when we went into this as a hobby or as a practice or I don't know, whatever the hell you want to call it, we were completely unshackled by any predispositions. We did not fall into a pattern of trying to emulate this or that other show. Now, we later did go back and listen to other shows because, one, some of them were great products.
You did.
And two, it was certainly good to hear how other people were doing it. And I see this in the same way as an RPG. And sure, you might need someone to give you a few pointers if you just don't get the concept of role-playing in general. But it seems like I could give you a 5 or 10 minute pitch on what a role-playing game is, hand you this and a tube of dice, and you could go run your own game and never be intimidated by it.
Yeah, you play pretend with dice rolls to resolve ambiguous situations.
Exactly.
The end.
Wait, and one
there's
thing
nothing more to it.
One thing I'm really noticing, too, is we talked a lot about implied setting. The weapons, the armor, the name of the abilities, all of that actually gives you a lot of setting without actually defining the setting.
The fact that endurance is called grit.
Yeah.
I mean, that alone.
The game started a lot bigger. I think with a lot of games, it goes in the opposite direction. That they write something, and then finishing the game is a process of adding more stuff to flesh it out. And this went in the opposite direction, where I had the game, but it wouldn't fit. And so I had to cut and cut and cut and look for ways to reduce something from two sentences to one sentence and, you know, make sure that all the words were as good as I could get them. And so things like making it grit as opposed to calling it health or something like that, those were deliberate choices to get some sense of the genre as efficiently as I could.
Well, I think this has also somewhat encouraged me as a wannabe writer, because for years I've been promising products I never deliver.
I did the same thing. That's why that was a big part of this.
As I'm sitting here looking at this, it's like, well, I don't know that I'm ever going to get around to producing a 300-page book, but a one-page book? Yeah, I can do that.
With this one book, looking through it, I could easily run a comedy game. I could run a very hard edge, tough Western game, because looking at these numbers, this can be a very brutal game if you play it like that. You can be one-shotting people with these weapons very easily.
So, quick question here.
But if you look at the little bit on unarmed combat, and you look at some of the abilities like innocence, if you want to not have a very lethal game, you can do that. You can have lots of saloon brawls, and people aren't dying, and people are just getting knocked out, and, you know, people can set up their character to avoid death. So, yeah, I think there's some latitude.
Have you ever contemplated, and I realize this flies in the face of what we've just been talking about, have you ever contemplated creating a second pocketbook, a setting book, or a little bit of extra rules? You have two books together, and there's your player's handbook and your monstrous manual.
Absolutely. One of the things I'm working on right now is another perk for our contributors, which is a little adventure. It's one of the one-page dungeons that I wrote that I'm converting for Weird West, so it's going to have all the stats and everything. And that's a buried UFO and the silver mine kind of scenario. And I'm also looking at
a barrier peaks kind of thing.
That's one of those old modules I never actually had a look at, but it's that Tommyknockers, Stephen King kind of thing. The Transformers, the UFO has been buried for a million years, and then they dig it up and it's got all sorts of crazy stuff in it. But yeah, I've also been thinking about an expanded game where we might have a few of these little books. So one would be the adventurer's book, and one would be game mastering advice, and then there'd be monsters and obstacles, and maybe a book of magic. So there'd be a little set of maybe four books. So that's one of the things I've been looking at.
I love that you take the time to do a description with as little space as you have. You even have a time in there for describing how to run an adventure, and it's a paragraph maybe, but it's all you need. And as someone who's very recently even talked about how I think you do need a lot of that, what is a role-playing game, I think this serves another purpose. Looking at this, I've already read through during the course of sitting here this entire book, and I'm confident I could sit down and run this system no problem at all. That to me is impressive, because I get nervous about new systems a lot.
Well, and even if you couldn't, it wouldn't take you very long to refer to the rules to figure out how to solve something.
Yeah, considering that in the 8 pages previously described, one of them is the cover, one of them is a chart, so you really only actually have 6 pages to read. And when I say page, I'm talking about 3 inches by 4.5 inches. So
of 4-point font.
It is a little font.
I don't know if it's quite 4-point, but it is a little.
Stuart, no, I don't have a copy in front of me, but when Dan was rubbing it up against the microphone, I was picking up a lot by osmosis. But from a pure business standpoint, how well has this done for you?
Well, with Dan's purchase, he's made $2 whole.
Oh, no, he gave Dan a copy, so Dan hasn't paid him anything. He's actually in the hole right now because of this.
I'm expecting you that you light your caviar trays with $100 bills or anything, but you know, I'm just curious, has this been a worthwhile business effort for you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. When I was working on the project, I was trying to decide, you know, what should I charge for this? And then I remembered the guy in RoboCop on the TV saying, "I'll buy that for a dollar." So I was like, all right, that's it. It's going to be a dollar. It's a gold bestseller on DriveThru RPG now.
Congratulations.
Which means it sold a lot.
Good work,
but you know, it's only a dollar. And, you know, if this had been a $20 or $30 book, wow, I'd be driving a new car or something. But
I would be so tempted to take the file and just do a control F. Okay, shotgun, replace with laser gun. Okay, weird space, release now.
The thought has crossed my mind. But
Stuart, I know a good lawyer by the name of John Graniff.
John Graniff!
And Wayne, I have a job offer. It just came out from Palladium.
When you say drive a new car, this would be a car that you hijacked with the money that you made from selling your books to buy a gun off the street. Is that what you mean?
Well, it's a funny thing because all the things that we've been saying so far, you know, how this is great for new players and I like this and, you know, it sounds like, you know, the idea is resonating with them and it's a really good thing for the hobby. But for the business side of it, to be completely honest, I mean, if you're doing it as a money-making venture, you make more money selling $20 books than you do selling $1
books. Well, I mean, yeah, let's just say living wage here at a dollar a pop, and I don't remember what DriveThru take is, but let's say they gave you the full dollar, which obviously they don't. I mean, to make a living wage, you'd have to sell what, tens of thousands of these every year. So, yes. And obviously,
I mean, I didn't have to pay a designer because I designed the logo, right, or an illustrator. So I'm happy with that, but it's not business advice I'd give to Wizards of the Coast to sell D&D for a dollar.
I couldn't do my own cover art, but the rest of the site, I mean, I could easily do an MS Word in a matter of not much time at all.
I can't do my own cover art, but I can write Keith Curtis a check, which also gets you cover art.
Yeah. Or Stuart. That's the thing about Stuart. Stuart, you actually did the art for the cover of this.
Yes.
And as we mentioned earlier, you do some character art, which is how I got in touch with you. Let's talk about these minis, though. So right now you're running, is it a Kickstarter or Indiegogo? Where is this?
Yeah, I unfortunately, you can only run a Kickstarter if you live in the United States.
That's right. And I forgot about that.
I live in the almost United States, which is 20 minutes from the border.
Yeah, you're still a foreigner.
All you Canadians live right on our border. You make me nervous.
It's the nice
They're
going to
cross over, start taking our jobs. That's what's going to happen.
What's that all about?
Okay, so it's on Indiegogo. I want you to talk to me for a little bit about these minis. Give me some of the minis you guys are working on. And my follow-up question, which I'll just go ahead and ask now, is what would I do with these minis? Because there's no mini rules in this book. Well, there's mini rules in this book, like M-I-N-I, but there's no rules for the use of miniatures. And is that kind of intended that it's just sort of, hey, do whatever the hell you feel like with these things? Like,
my intention is to produce a concise set of miniature rules in the same way that I created a concise set of role-playing game rules.
Gotcha.
But in addition to that, there are a whole bunch of small-scale skirmish miniature rules that you can use with different genres. One of my favorite sites to look at is Tabletop Gaming News. If you go there, there's so many companies and so many rule sets for miniature gaming and all sorts of neat genres. And, you know, if you want to play 1930s explorers of the Amazon, someone's producing miniatures for that. And there'll be a little rule set for paddle boats and all sorts of cool stuff.
Malaria.
Yeah, exactly. Now I have I'm looking around the room here and I have a bunch of Wild West buildings that I ordered from a company over in the UK and they're laser cut MDF and they fold together. And there's a guy in Illinois that I get a lot of my Wild West 28mm miniatures from. But because this is Weird West, there was some character ideas I had that I'd like to see added to that that I could use with my gaming, but I also wanted to make them a bit more useful beyond just the Western genre. So the characters that we chose, they were definitely for the Weird West, but you could use them in other genres. So So the vampire, instead of being another cowboy vampire, he's a Victorian vampire. So if you're playing Gaslight Cthulhu, or if you're playing any sort of steampunk thing, it's a miniature that would work for that genre. The werewolf. There's not a lot of really great werewolves out there, which is weird. Whenever I look for werewolves, there's some of the really larger scale, like 32 millimeter ones, but I didn't see a lot that looked like the kind of werewolves that I see in werewolf movies I like. So that was going to be our werewolf. In the same way that my approach to Weird West is sort of inspired by music videos and genre movies and TV shows and stuff, a lot of the character ideas for our miniatures are, you know, not directly based on those, but drawing inspiration from some popular genre TV and movies.
Moving aside from Weird West, tell me about the rest of your gaming life. What are some of your favorite titles? What are some of your big inspirations?
I think there's some really nice things in a lot of different genres. I think one of the reasons people come back to fantasy gaming and that traditional dungeon crawl kind of thing is because the setup for that does some nice things for a group game together. It makes everyone have to be in the same place at the same time, and, you know, these underground mazes, they channel you into making interesting decisions about direction and strategy and things like that. So, like so many gamers, I like the traditional fantasy of D&D or whatever else. But there's a lot of different games that I like. I like some of the setting stuff from the old World of Darkness, even though I haven't touched that in a lot of years.
Apparently no one has. The books are all gone.
we were joking about Palladium, and it's funny. I think there's so much that I don't like about some aspects of the system, but there's so much enthusiasm in the books, and yes, some of the settings that they come up with are so much fun. And I think when I'm looking at my gaming bookshelf, the books that I have in storage versus the books that I've left out, there's this big Palladium section, and I've got all my Robotech books there.
You know, I have to agree with you on that, because as much as we bag on Palladium and our good old boy Kevin on the show, the honest truth of the matter is that I own Palladium books, and I think part of what agitates me about them is there is so much potential there.
Yes.
Some of the ideas, and some of the setting, in some of the, God forbid, well, maybe not in the rules, but in everything else about the games. I mean, there's so much potential there if they would just...
Yeah. It's just collapsing under its own weight.
Well, it's that, and also on top of that, there's a lot of things that I don't per se think role-playing games need to be updated just for sake of being updated. But in the case of Palladium, there's a lot of rough edges around their rule system where I really wish they would make a second edition. Not so everybody has to go rebuy their books, but just to consolidate and streamline these ideas, refine and maybe update a few points of technology or history. And I think that really they have a lot of great products. It bugs me because it's a diamond in a huge amount of rough. And if they just work on the rough, it really would be something great.
Palladium is based on AD&D. I mean, it started out Palladium Fantasy as a set of house rules for D&D.
Boy, it sure did. I remember looking at a book and I'm thinking, I feel like I'm looking at the first edition book, but they just added in like wolf people.
Yeah, and they totally did. And then when you get into Robotech, they add some things like mega damage, but it continues along that way. And I'm a big Robotech fan, so I never got the feeling of the TV show or some of the new stuff like Macross Zero, which is great. And so that's one of the reasons I got into Battletech. And I know you guys like Battletech, and I'm a big Battletech fan. But it doesn't quite get Robotech either, because it's more slow-moving.
Battletech is a high-tech setting with a low-tech feel. If you even go through the technical readouts like 3025, it really feels like you're seeing the textual form of a History Channel documentary on the fighters of World War II or the tanks of World War II. And that's how the game plays, is you have these big, slow plotting machines that just kind of grind each other down. It's very World War I, World War II in feel. And it certainly is not going to capture the fast-paced, high-action sort of play that comes out of Robotech. And that
Robotech is jets.
Yes.
You know, it's jets naval first, aviation. Robots second, and the robots need to be as fast and quick and lightning as the jets.
Absolutely, and destruction was absolute. Yes. Hitting somebody meant they were either disabled or destroyed.
Vaporized.
Yeah, it was not like Battletech where you can pound on a mech for a while and it's still moving. If you connect with your shot, they are screwed. And it really
Palladium does not capture that.
Well, right.
All.
And there was a time many years ago like when I was a kid, one of the first RPGs I tried to self-write before getting my first actual product, that Star Trek game, was a Robotech game. And the way that I had it set up was that it was much more about jockeying. That basically you are in a dogfight with one or more other parties. You're going for the position to get the shot. Because whoever gets the shot is in all probability going to instantly end that fight. The Palladium rules don't capture that. You just pile damage on and pile damage on and pile damage on. And even though they have armor for various locations, it really all only goes to the main body. And it just did not at all capture that sense to me of you're dogfighting battle pods. Or you're really trying to cut and juke and dodge around an Invid shock trooper. It didn't get it for me, but there was so much about it that was great.
There's a whole bunch of games like that. And I think one of the things that more recently I've started warming up to is this idea of not feeling like each game has to be a discrete thing. And you know what? I can cannibalize from one game and just drag it on over to the other. And no one's going to tell me no, because it's my game and I can do that if I want to. So some of those Palladium books that have been, you know, maybe Gathering Dust, you know, why not pull those off the shelf, open them up, pull out some of those ideas and excitement and bring it into your D&D or your vampire or whatever else, you know, and make the game, you know, what you want it to be.
How can I fit my mech into a dungeon?
It was funny. It was brought in there as an egg.
It's funny. Some of the mechs, and if you look at the mega damage and everything else, and you do all the math, how many hit points it would have, it's pretty ridiculous. But I've played in this game I was talking about, the buried UFO one, where there is a lot more science fiction in it. So it's not quite mechs, but I like Doctor Who, where the show starts out and you're in some historical setting, and then some supernatural thing gets introduced, and then by, you know, the last quarter, you've figured out that it wasn't a supernatural thing, it was some sort of alien thing. And, you know, it was technology-based as opposed to magic-based. And I run a lot of scenarios like that where, you know, by the time you go through it, something that started out looking like occultish turns out to be alien in nature. And I think that's kind of Lovecraftian as well. So I think there's some room for borrowing some of that stuff.
Have you ever passed this little micro book to a new gamer and seen how well they're able to latch on to the concept of gaming from this book?
I've only run it with people at conventions. The only new gamers who have looked at it and responded to it are when people tell me that they printed it out and they're playing it with their kids. And my kids, who are still too young really to play role-playing games, and I'm not one of these parents who's pushing it on them, they'll look at it and they'll talk about it and they'll say, can we draw you pictures for your game? I'm like, yeah, sure. And they say, can I make a scary tree monster? I'm like, yeah, that sounds great. I'm gonna make a snake lady. I'm like, oh, that's great. And so they'll draw their pictures and they'll talk about what it is. So that's probably about the closest I've got to new gamers. Is I've heard anecdotally other people have had really good success with it because it's not this huge book, and I don't mind giving the printout to my kids and they can crumple it up and play with it.
These anecdotes, are they just about players or about people running it as well?
Oh, no, they're about games that people have run at conventions, games they've run with their kids.
Like, this is the first time I've ever run an RPG.
The first time people have played it. I don't think I've heard of any time where this is their first encounter, because I don't think you get that as much anymore. Because even if someone's playing an RPG for the first time, they're going to have played video games.
Fair point.
My son, who's 7 now, I thought, you know, one day we would get to this point and I would need to pick which RPG to take off the shelf and give to him. But, I mean, he's played Paper Mario, and it's a role-playing game, and he's played Legend of Zelda, and those are role-playing games. I mean, you're playing this character, and he adventures, and he gets gold, and he has to decide which items to equip and all that stuff. So it's not the same as, I think, when we were kids, and you were really sort of starting at the beginning, and what is this crazy thing?
So as I was prepping for this episode, I went around and did some reading both on your site and on some other sites where people
were doing. What do you do at work? I hate
Isn't
you
it clear?
So much.
You still have to ask? But I saw a lot of people, and I don't remember because honestly it all kind of blurred together as I was reading it, but I saw several people, and one of them may have been you commenting on your own game, referring to this thing as having an old school vibe. Now, I don't remember if you made that comment or not, but do you agree with that?
At it's such a funny thing. A lot of people, they say that it's got an old school vibe, and I'm happy to embrace that. I like older games, and I think in some ways it does. But most people do say, oh, this is an OSR game, this is an old school game, but it's got a lot of not old school stuff in it. I mean, there's no random character generation, it's point buy. A lot of the mechanics are, some of them are a little old, like you roll the dice for the damage from your weapon, but some other stuff isn't. So I think it's like a lot of games, I tried to take what I thought worked really well from older games, but also tried to think about what could we do that's new and different or maybe better or maybe just different.
Well, and I realize this may be opening up a huge can of semantic worms, which is probably the worst thing I can be doing in front of several thousand geeks, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it anyway. What exactly does that phrase mean to you, old school game?
I think it means a lot of different things to different people. And one of the
absolutely
things,
it's a Rorschach test in and of itself.
It's like saying indie game. What is an indie game?
Yeah.
There's no such thing.
But what does it mean to you?
To me, it means playing in that style that some of the older games had, where the focus was maybe not the same as the style of some of the newer games. So if I had to grossly characterize it, for me, I'd say the focus isn't as much on building a story, which I sort of generally see as one of the main focuses for some of the indie games, which is another one of those crazy terms, because anything on RPG now is pretty much an indie game. It doesn't have a focus on the object of the game is to tell a story, and I don't think the focus is on stat optimizing and tactics like you get from some of the more recent iterations of Pathfinder and D&D, where the numbers are really important and, you know, good tactical decisions in combat are really important. But from that, I mean, what I think of as being old school and what someone else thinks of as being old school could be totally different. And one of the things I'll point out to people is Dragonlance is old school, right? But Dragonlance tells you do this, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. And if the players deviate, hit them with the ruler and get them back on the rails. A totally different type of game than, you know, maybe one of the ones like, I don't know, Keep on the Borderlands, where it's like, here's a bunch of stuff, wander around, kill people, burn down the fort, we don't care, do whatever you feel like. And it's that very sandbox game. Those are both old school games, but they're both totally different. Whenever people talk about old school games, for me, the biggest thing that touches on for me is that they used to be a lot more about DIY. And so when I hear old school, for me, it's more about DIY than it is about whether or not the game is actually old or actually uses any sort of, you know, specific mechanic. And I don't mean the DIY from me, the game publisher. I mean from the people playing the game, where they feel more like they can change the game and do with it as they want, and that they're not as beholden to do exactly what the rule book says.
See, I've always had a problem with all of these terms. I may just go back to, I'm the type of person that doesn't like labels if they're not necessary.
I expect that from a ginger.
You know, there were always different kinds of games, except when there were only a couple. There are now different kinds of games. When someone says old school, like you mentioned, it's what they remember. What old school was for them is different from person to person. Indie games, to me, means nothing when it comes to genre-wise, because there are so many different types of games that right. have nothing to do with each other.
Well, and that's why I was really just kind of curious from Stuart's standpoint, what does the phrase mean to him? It's obviously a colloquial phrase with a very fuzzy, slippery meaning. And so
I think that's why there's so much fighting over
oh,
it.
Oh, yeah.
It's and not believe clearly
me, I don't think it means anything.
Well, I agree with you, John.
If you're an indie publisher and you publish old school games, literally, you rip open the space-time continuum and you explode things. You can't do both at the same time.
But that's why I was curious to hear what it meant to you, because I think what it means to you, if you feel this is an applicable label to your game, helps say something about what the game is attempting to capture. We're, you know, are we shipping this definition off to Merriam-Webster? Well, sure, we will. But
we'll do better. We'll put it on Wikipedia.
Yes, we will create our own Wikipedia article for it. But I was just curious what it meant to you, because I think that says something about your approach to writing this game, since you indicated that you felt that was an accurate label.
Online, when people ask me, what is old school, or do I think such and such is old school? I usually send the Fensler Films G.I. Joe parody thing about old school, where they're breakdancing. And they go, yay! And he goes, these beats are so fresh.
Who wants a body massage?
You know, this sad thing
that sort of ends it. So
The sad thing is 15 years from now, 20 years from now, somebody is going to look back and they're going to call D&D 4.0 old school.
Oh, I know.
It's going to happen.
It will be. It will be old school. I mean, it's like in music, because I listen to a lot of music. And I was in the car the other day, and they said, you know, old school coming up. And I'm like, oh, cool. It's going to be, you know, stuff from the 70s. And nope, it's stuff from the late 90s. And I'm like, oh, well, I guess it is, right? Wow. I guess it is.
Yeah.
It
I read somewhere that the half-life on nostalgia is like 12 or 13 years. So, yeah, we're getting there. The late 2E, early 3E era, you know, the Matrix came out, is now old school.
Yeah, and whenever anyone asks, you know, do you think my game is old school or OSR or anything like that, I usually just say yes before they even explain what their game is.
Because if they're looking for that label, it will make them feel good.
Sure, why not, right? I don't mind.
Old, new, indie, is it fun? If I put out a game, that's all I care about. Is it fun?
What is going to get you to spend that buck?
There are different approaches to games. Some games are very tactically focused, right? Like it's all about the miniatures and the spatial positioning on the table and your knowledge of the rules and resource management. I mean, that's a different kind of game than, I don't know, something like Fiasco, where the point of the game is to tell a really interesting story. And I think that's very different from a scenario puzzly based game where you're playing as your character. We've set up a premise and we just watch it unfold and see what happens. Those are definitely different types of games, but I think there's probably old school examples of all of those and, you know, probably new school examples of the same. But I mean, it's one of those nerd things where people, they get their identity politics wrapped up in these definitions. And I think
it's very, very true.
You've hit on there where I think labels are useful. Miniatures, miniatures, war games, puzzle games,
ginger politics,
you know, story-driven game. Those are things that actually mean something that you can easily define based on looking at the name of it. That's what I think is useful. If it could be a category on DriveThruRPG, and I can just look and say, I want a puzzle game. Okay, click. That
Control
makes
F
sense.
Bard.
I think one of the reasons I'm put off by some of that stuff is when I first started getting into following role-playing game discussions on the internet, there was all sorts of RPG theory where people had everything defined as these different types of games, and if the kind of games that I liked wasn't even included in these different definitions, so therefore it didn't exist for a little while. And I think if it helps an individual person have more fun with their game, then that's great. But I don't think I need to know whether Battletech is this type of game or that type of game to play it and have fun with it.
I think that a lot of people try to put labels on this different stuff, like indie or modern or old school, or even like the really pared down. It's like, you are this type of gamer and you play these type of games. A lot of times when it comes to like internet discussions, people put these labels on there to either back up their point on why the game is so good, or to back up their point on why this game is so bad. This is such an old school crap game. It's like, this game is so great because it's so old school. And it's like,
and where I want to see labels is finding new games.
Yeah.
There are so many games out there that if you know I am looking for a tactical miniatures game, that is something you can go and search for and find.
Not Dread.
Well,
you know, not
other cases where it's not so clear cut. I mean, you could arguably say D&D is or is not a tactical minis game.
Yeah.
I mean, I've played it
I think it's a tactical role-playing system.
It's a toolbox. It's like Legos. A lot of games are
it
like
can
a box
fit
of Legos.
That function, so I would put it in there.
And I think you could put multiple tags on it. But and also the definitions with what Wayne's talking about, because what Wayne's talking about is not internet wanking.
Nope, tag words, keywords.
You're not bending to your
search
argument.
Search engine optimization is what I'm talking about.
As written, D&D is a tactical role-playing game system.
Right. All right.
As written.
You know, there are words I'll use to describe my personal approach to games. And I'll say things like, I really like choose your own adventures, and I really like Scooby-Doo, Doctor Who type scenarios and a lot of exploration as opposed to combat, and I like it spooky. And so then I'm describing what I like, and I'll say I also like to roll the dice out in the open, and then we all try to figure out what the results of that mean in the story, rather than me have an idea, make some dice rolling noises, and then tell you what my idea was. I don't think that's a genre.
Shared.
That's just me, right?
It is totally just you and no one else. By the way, come down to St. Louis. We're going to game. It'll be great. It'll be magic.
All right. Well, I
John's
tried.
Not invited.
That actually leads me. I have one. One last question. Do you prefer GMing or playing?
Oh, that is a good question. I think I like GMing because I can do the prep stuff that I enjoy. I can make the maps and I can make the cards and I can make the GM screen and I can do all that sort of stuff that's sort of parallel to the game that is part of my hobby. I can make the miniatures and I can paint things and that's all a lot of fun. I do like being a player in a game. Sometimes it's hard to find one that's in the style that I really like. I guess I prefer GMing in that way, but I mean, it's lots of fun to play too. I'm happy to play in a lot of different games, miniature games, Arkham Horror, even stuff like Fiasco once in a while. That's fun.
Cool. I think that's where we're going to wrap this one up. For those of you that are going to be there at Fear the Con next week, I want to say an early hello for those of you that are not. We are going to record an episode at Fear the Con. I don't know when it will be released or if there will be an episode during the week of Fear the Con because of the fact that I'll be doing the tourism stuff. And we usually keep a show ahead, but right now we're not a show ahead. So there may be a week off. I don't know. We'll figure it out. But either way, we will catch you when we catch you. And in the meantime, don't forget to go and check the show notes because we covered a lot of stuff. And I'm going to try to link all that in the show notes, including some visuals on how I made a book out of a single sheet of paper. Yeah. So,
and you need to take a picture of my book.
Yeah.
And Dan's and my bound copy that he made.
Thank you all for tuning in. Stuart, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Chris, thanks for making editing harder. As for the rest of you, we will catch you next time.
See ya.
I'm here to help, Dan.
I didn't hear any.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2012. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.